unregenerated ox. But that as these faculties are regenerated, he returns to his universal citizenship. That he neither needs the world, and for in that matter does the world need him. For the world will never understand him, and he will never understand the other. The boy and the ox, strangely, have an interval between them which is not easy to cross. Yet each in its own way achieves a victory over the mystery of separateness. And that is represented in this particular story. In meditation, the being and its mind, the emotions, the whole psychic integration that we know, suddenly experiences an aloneness in space. The self and the personality together float in the clouds. They are no longer attached or related to any objectivity whatsoever. Yet the meditating mystic still thinks, still feels, is still moved by all the most refined and transmuted emotions and moods. But still these things are not tied to earth. He does not need this earth to know beauty. He does not need this world to know wisdom. He does not require this physical planet on which to stand, nor does he need any of the things which belong to it. For strangely, all things necessary are in himself, and always have been. And in himself is the comradeship and companionship of the eternal. So in our picture, the meditating mystic has suddenly experienced his own existence in a vast and infinite area of eternal being. In his meditation, he has left the world behind. Although he may still be seated upon old earth itself, he has forgotten it. He looks out with a clarified vision and beholds only the stars and space and himself. And he looks out from within himself to the outer part of himself. He looks from his soul through his eyes. And his soul is the boy, and his eyes are the ox. They are still two beings, but they have become much closer. And it is through the eyes of the ox that the boy sees the fields of space. Even as the meditating mystic is aware by his inner sensory perception of his own relationship to both time and eternity. He still is. He still experiences the strange, fleeting sense of selfness. As long as self remains, the ox is there. But the ox in space, like the self in space, is at disadvantage. Because space does not belong to selves, it belongs to eternities. So it is only reasonable and natural that we should turn the next page, and suddenly we have another peculiar situation. We are back again to the situation we started with. We are back to the point where the boy is standing again in the garden or by the side of the cliffs and mountains on the edge of a precipice overlooking the sea, and above him also are clouds and mountains and the sky, the constellation shines forth. The boy holds up his hands in amazement. There is no bull. Something has happened. This very ethereal bull that was floating around on the clouds has now vanished utterly. And in this vanishment of the bull, in the ancient concept of the mystic meditation, the individual has simply extinguished the sense of separateness between its own nature and every other nature in space. And as the Swami Vivekananda tells us in his work on Raja Yoga, there is suddenly only one. And if we want to say that, what from one perspective to another, we can say, this one is myself. Or we can also, with equal propriety, say, this one is something else, everything else. But if the one is self, then everything is part of self. If the one is the something else, then I am part of something else, because there can only be one. And it is either I or not I. If it is I include all. If it is not I, then I am included in all. So the boy holds up his hands in astonishment. The whole mystery of duality has vanished in the Pythagorean monad. And here, it is hard to know what really happened to the ox. Whether the boy has transmuted the ox into himself, whether he has cast aside the instrumentality of the sensory perception, whether they have been absorbed back into the spirit from which they came, whether man now experiences with new faculties, faculties that are no longer individualized or personified, but have an enduring existence in a universal condition. And in any event, man reaches what might be termed in Buddhism the Bodhisattva experience. He comes very close now to the portals of the Supreme Mystery. He has observed one by one everything vanishing away. Each step of the path, something that was dark has become lighter. Something that has become lighter has become fainter. Until at last, there is nothing really left but a point of consciousness. It is as though a person was passing slowly into sleep. The last memory was this strange sense of existence. No longer where we exist or how we exist or what moves or motivates our existence, but just this one fleeting realization that we must exist. Because without this existence, we could not know that our existence was slipping away. So there is this mysterious movement in which nothing remains of the elaborate complex of self, of person, of things, of emotions, of appetites, of desires, of ambitions, of hopes, and fears, and resolutions. Now there is nothing remaining of these things except a kind of conscious watcher, a beholder of things that can behold everything but itself, but has reached that point in which there is no longer anything to behold. And we come to the very edge of our supreme problem. Namely, if there is no illusion in man, if there is no further retention of worldliness, if there is no link between the individual and the corporeality which he has left behind, then is it not true that in meditation the world fades out, that all these things have a ceasing because they no longer are needed? And that which is not necessary does not endure. So the boy, to his astonishment, sees the whole elaborate pageantry of his own nature evaporate. He sees his memory and his mind and his thoughts and his feelings all fading away. Yet in a mysterious manner he exists, for he is capable of seeing them fade. He is capable of surviving the loss of the bowl, which means that the individual life, the consciousness in man, is capable of surviving the death of the mind. And this is one of the great points in Zen philosophy. And I think it is one of the points that will sometime have to be reconsidered in Western psychology. where we're going to have to realize that it is the thought that produces the thinker, and not the thinker producing the thought. That in the beginning was not the mind, but the thought. And the thought was everywhere and in everything. And in order to express itself, the thought brought forth the mind. And the mind became the instrument, and thought and soul the mind. But the mind can die again, and the thought remains. And this thought is a kind of vagrant sense of existence, moving and floating upon the deep sea of meditation. And in it we find the concept of the bodhisattvic life, in which by degrees the individual comes so close to the dividing line between the state of being and the state of eternity that he can hardly realize which he occupies at any given time. And so we then turn the diagram from this to the tenth figure, the last of the figures. And what do we have? The boy is gone. The ox is gone. The trees are gone. And all that remains is the Zen Taoist symbol of eternity, the circle. This is the circle that a good Zen priest can draw with one stroke of the brush, and it will be perfect. A perfect circle drawn freehand. But in this circle is the end of the mystery, either for Taoism or for Zen. For now there is nothing that remains except the infinite mystery itself. The mystery of the samadhi. The mystery of the mahaparinirvana. The mystery of the dying out of all the fires of existence. The end of suffering. The end of the long road that leads to the end of suffering. There is no longer the shepherd or the ox. There is no longer that which causes pain or that which experiences pain. There is no longer the thought flying out like a bird seeking a place to land. There is no longer any land. There is no longer anything except the infinite expanse of the inevitable itself. In this, as the Buddha says, the drop of water has returned to the infinite ocean. All separateness has ceased. All condition as we know it has ceased. And if you wish to know the incredible profundity of this mystery, you only have to remember that it happens to you every night when you go to sleep. Suddenly, you are not. And yet, not having an existence, you are never aware completely or totally of the end of an existence. And suddenly, in the morning, you awaken again, out of not existence, into existence again. And you pick up the threads and strains of life, and you go on. And each little day we live is rounded by a sleep. And all of us can sometimes wonder where the dream really is, whether man is dreaming of strange things or whether strange things are dreaming of man. We do not know, but we depend upon certain orientations to clarify. There are examples known in which dream life and active life have been so closely interrelated that it has been impossible for the individual to tell which was the dream and which the reality. This is part of our problem. But Zen ends not in a frustration, in the sense that Western scholars have insisted on assuming that the Buddhists were nihilists, that they were some strange type of extinctionists, in which to them the supreme end of everything was to be nothing. This is the first thought that may come to mind. The idea that the only way you can escape from pain is to die. The only way you can escape from your mind is for the mind to die, or for you to die and leave the mind behind. This is not really the substance of the matter at all, however. For there is a great deal more to this Buddhist philosophy than extinction. We have extinguished the man, and we have extinguished the ox. The world is gone, and nothing but the circle remains. And the circle is reality. So how shall we estimate the nature of reality? Have we right to say how deep it is or how wide? Have we any way of estimating what is locked within it? Do we know what potentials may emerge from it? We have the experience here of beholding an unknown, or coming into the presence of a mystery. Perhaps one name we give to this mystery is space, and space is an excellent symbol of Tao. But on this side of the mystery, we behold space stretched limitless, beyond the galaxies that fill the firmament, or are scattered and strewn about through the infinite expansions and extensions of time and distance. And from this invisible, mysterious space, we know we have to derive all that we are. It is from space that comes the atomic and nuclear energy that we fear today. For it means that this thing that seems to be empty around us is really filled with an infinite life so vast that it can shatter in an instant all the material structures that it supports. So we see from this mystery of space, flowing downward into matter, the infinite diversity of creation. We see coming out of space all the planets and all the lives upon them. We see man coming out of space. We know that his nutrition is derived from space. Everything that we know, everything that we are, began somewhere, somehow, as a seed in something that we cannot see, and the seed itself we could not see. And only after ages of growth did this thing become manifest to us. So we are indeed like a great tree with its roots in an invisible heaven above. A silent, abstract earth that seems to be utterly transparent and to go on forever and to be fully empty. And yet, we have to be wrong. For this space, which is the most rarefied of atmospheres, contains everything that has ever been or ever can be, even as it supports everything that at present exists. What happens then if we now ascend to union with this space that to now we have considered emptiness? Supposing this space was a strange wall, invisible, but nevertheless as adamantine, as the hardest and most unbreakable granite. Supposing this space is the mysterious looking glass of Alice, who not only gave us the little story of her adventures in Wonderland, but tells us of how she went through the looking glass to another world. What would happen if we stepped through to the other side of space? Would it be empty? Would it be a complete vacuum? Is it possible that beyond space itself there is this other side, and that from this other side other things are being generated, created, and fashioned to flow out into other dimensions of existence we know nothing of? Buddhism takes the position that when man is restored to identity with reality, which is the Mahaparinirvana, when in that moment he is born for the first time into the true universe, He is born into the world as it really is. He goes out of the sphere of seeming into the sphere of being. And he comes, therefore, not to the end of everything, but merely to the waking out of a sleep. And what we call the reabsorption into eternity through meditation is the gradual releasing of the individual from the nightmare of some strange dream which he calls existence. But what we call this way of life is a dreaming of the spirit. And suddenly, in the Mahaparinirvana, the individual awakens. He awakens from the nightmare of selfishness. He awakes from the horrid dreams of pain. He wakes from all these doubts and fears about the finality of things. He awakes from the terrors of an atomic age. He awakes from the ruthlessness of competitive enterprise, from the endless thoughtlessness of mortals. Suddenly, this universe changes. He then realizes that what he has called life was this life of seeming, this life of make-believe, this life which was nothing but the elaborate tapestry woven by his own sensory perceptions, a world of illusion that exists only because he has faculties of illusion with which to cognize it. A world that has substance only because it comes within the registry of a strange, insubstantial pattern within himself. So just as a man in a terrible nightmare is rescued suddenly by awaking, and in an instant finds himself back in a reasonable existence, so to the Buddhist of ancient times, the Mahaparinirvana was this waking up into a real existence. What it is like, we cannot know. What it means, we cannot even comprehend. But we believe it and hold it firmly to be the beginning of man's true existence. We hold it to be something which, when it is attained, brings to the individual for the first time a positive relationship with life, instead of being forever opposed to life, instead of being forever under the displeasure of willful gods or under the pressure of unchanging laws. Man suddenly, for the first time, comes into the benevolence of the all-beautiful, the all-wonderful, and the all-good. And in order to signify this wonderful, incredible state of things, the Mahayana Buddhists, from which the Zen derived most of its teaching, picture against the mysterious background of the cosmic shades and shadows the rising figures of the Dhyana Buddhas. They recognize there that somewhere behind the veil of things, there will sit in eternal meditation the mysterious realities that govern all things. Though these realities go on forever in the quiet, unchanging contemplation of the infinite itself. Man can only find these beings by becoming like them. He knows them when he discovers the realities in himself, and as he finds in his own heart and soul the quietude of the meditative life, the dim shadows of these great meditating principles begin to intrigue him, begin to mean something to him, something away from and apart from all this worldliness which we generally consider. So in the story of the ten bulls, we end with a circle that seems to be frustration, but which is actually ultimate and inevitable opportunity. Man moves from the finite, which boxes him in, to the infinite, in which there are no limitations upon himself. But he finds this unlimited existence only a vacuum as far as his present faculties and sensibilities and conditions of consciousness are concerned. He cannot know the meanings of these things that lie beyond. When the bull and the boy have both vanished, when the world of things as we know the world simply no longer endures. Yet the boy and the bull have not ultimately or utterly vanished. That which has a nature never ceases. That which has an existence somewhere within it can never cease existing. And as Buddha himself tells us, he says, I am not an extinctionist. I am not an atheist. I am not one who teaches the exhaustion of life into darkness and not being. He says, rather, that what he teaches is a way of life that leads to the end of sorrow. You notice that in all the Buddhist writings, there is no actual statement of man attaining happiness. There is no one in the, no Buddhist statement of the fact that someday man is going to be filled with unspeakable joy. There is no radiant heaven world in old Buddhism such as we have in other religions, although Mahayana to a measure filled this interval with a blessed region. But in the original teachings of Buddha, there was no promise of good. There was simply the promise of the end of evil. This is because in the philosophy of Buddha, the human being, the human mind, the human nature, is simply incapable of a positive statement of reality. We cannot define that which we consider as ultimate good. What we can do only is to define that which is not good. Therefore, we cannot say what this thing will be, but we can gradually remove from it those qualities which we know that it cannot be. We cannot, therefore, say we come in the end to great joy, but rather, as far as we can tell, we come in the end to great quietude, the great quietude of the circle. We have come to the end of pain. We have come to the end of sorrow. Now, what is the state of no longer being sorrowful? Is this merely another way of saying we have found joy? Is the absolute extinction of sadness the full expression of joy? Or is that some strangely quiet thing in which there is neither joy nor sorrow? And if for that matter we think carefully, is this not in itself, this quietude, the ultimate joy? These things we do not know. We can only use the faculties that we have to estimate as best we can. To Buddhism, the nearest we can come to reality is to extinguish the illusion. When we are no longer deceived by that which is not so, we are free. When we are no longer victims of the unreasonable, victims of ignorance, superstition, and fear within ourselves, victims of selfishness, self-interest, when gradually we have released ourselves from these falsenesses, then we have finally come as far as man could come. For these purifications of man's nature exhaust man. And that which is left when man is no longer imperfect in any respect, that which is left we can hardly call man. When we have taken everything from man which divides him from a superior form of life, only that superior form then continues. So what we know of man, what we know as man, is merely the human imperfection. The man we know exists only because he is not complete. If he becomes complete, he vanishes away. If he becomes perfect, he is no longer recognizable. He is beyond our grasp, beyond our span of thinking. So when we say that man becomes perfect, we are actually extinguishing man himself. When we say that man becomes completely good, we are extinguishing all of the qualities of his nature. For in the perfection of anything, there is release from all the stress and striving of parts and things unfinished. So all this stream of fragments, all these diverse pressures and appetites and attitudes flow back into the mysterious circle from which they came. And then, as it were, the door of the circle closes, and there is nothing here anymore. But this is in no way evidence that anything has ceased. It just merely means that everything has its full existence beyond our faculties. The only part of us that is real we cannot see. The only part of the infinite that is real we cannot see. All that we can see are the extensions of things, the bones and framework of a living creature. But the living creature is invisible. And just as the soul of man cannot be known directly by any sense that we possess, so likewise the soul of the universe is not in the stars, not in the elements, not in the vast pageantries of things, but as a silent mystery behind these things. Yet it is the soul that has made all else possible. It is the life in man that, though invisible, makes him alive. If things then all return to their invisibles, it merely means that they have returned to their realities, the rock of life itself, the very substance that is unchanging. And if in the wisdom of the infinite mind and the infinite consciousness, it is right and proper, from this dark, mysterious mystery of the void, as the Chinese call it, from this doctrine of the void, from this invisible center of the strange ring of existence, there can at any time pour forth the seeds of worlds. For this mysterious circle is full of life in every part. It is germinal and seminal. Everything that is alive comes from it and returns to it. So that there is no right to say that the things that disappear cease, any more than it is right to say that things exist only because they appear. These are attitudes that we have. But in Buddhist psychology, we go beyond these. We go to the position or the relation of things to themselves only, not their relation to other things. And out of this concept, I think we can get the main pattern or picture of the story of the ten bulls, which is, of course, something we can meditate on for years if we want to, without ever exhausting its potential. But it does challenge in us the consideration of all these old legends and this fabled story and the lore and the wisdom of antiquity. And each will interpret it some way according to his own insight. He will identify. He is either the boy or the bull. Then he is both. Then he is neither. And lastly, he is the circle that goes on forever, that has neither beginning nor end. And by these identities, he discovers his own growth in the mystery of existence. Well, I think our time is pretty well up, so that's our little story. And we hope that you will find it interesting and worthy of consideration. And if you don't have a copy of the book, I think you might want to have it, because I don't know where you're going to find these pictures more conveniently than in this little volume. So we leave it to your consideration. I'd like to also call to your attention that this evening, after our talk, our little gift shop will be open, and also our library with its exhibit and with other art treasures and things there for you to see, in order that as the time to Christmas gets nearer and nearer, you could do a little last-minute shopping, or perhaps look around a little and relax in a rather pleasant atmosphere in the pressures of last-minute shopping. In any event, also I would say that although we have no class here next Wednesday evening, the gift shop will also be open Wednesday evening next week, so that if you have the time and the inclination, perhaps you will find here a convenient place to do a little of your last-minute shopping. I might also point out that in our gift shop, you can secure gift coupons or little gift certificates in which you can give your friend a little card, a rather attractive, beautiful Christmas card, which they can come in with and select whatever they wish to secure for themselves. So if you're in doubt about what to get someone, perhaps one of these gift certificate cards will be appropriate. We hope you will take a look at the exhibit in the library. We think it is a very good story of the unfoldment of man's consciousness and his struggle for learning. And we think that it tells how, perhaps symbolically at least, man captured his thoughts and his dreams and his hopes, the mysterious forms of letters and of words and of characters and sentences. And these, in a way, became also these symbolic oxen that became the instruments of his own purpose. Man identified with his thoughts, put them into words, and created literature, created a world of learning for other men to enjoy. Men passing through the ages of learning turned from one book to another, from one leaf to another, until they found in the simple stories of Zen perhaps the whole substance of the written word. You will find some interesting examples of man's struggles for learning, struggles for insight, and how he gradually recorded the best that he knew for the good of other men. The history of the written word in our library exhibit, we think you will find interesting. So we hope you'll visit the gift shop and the library, and we will see you all, we hope, next Sunday. Thank you very much.